May I please the court? My name is Britta Cruz, registration number 41572, and I'm appearing for Mr. Tucker. I'd like to reserve at least 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal, please. Although I believe each issue I raised in my brief has merit, given that I only have 15 minutes today, I'd like to focus on just the jurisdictional issue pertaining to the Uniform Mandatory Disposition of Detainers Act. The UMDDA provides that once a prisoner makes a valid request for speedy disposition of a detainer, then the burden shifts from the prisoner to the trial court and the district attorney to ensure that the prisoner is tried within 180 days of notice of his request. If not, then the court loses jurisdiction and the case must be dismissed. Here, there was no dispute below that both the district court and the district attorney had actual notice of Mr. Tucker's request on May 19, 2008, which triggered their obligation to bring Mr. Tucker to trial by November 15, 2008. However, trial occurred on January 13th, some 2 months after that November 15th deadline. At issue in this case is the trial court's retroactive ruling that Mr. Tucker was not entitled to trial by November 15th because the UMDDA was told for two periods that occurred very early on in the pretrial process. The first tolling was for defense counsel's waiver of the 30-day preliminary hearing rule. The second tolling was for defense counsel's request for a continuance to review a plea offer the district attorney had extended that same day. Now, as I argue in my briefs, that first tolling was improper as a matter of law because it related to an event that occurred before the UMDDA clock had even started to run, so there was nothing to toll. Hence, the only issue before this court is really whether that second period of tolling was proper, and the answer to that question is no.
Ms. Cruz, let me ask you on the first tolling period.
Sure.
The trial court did not hold that full period of time against Mr. Tucker, correct? It just held the difference between the 30-day normal period and the actual time of the extension.
Right. He subtracted out the 30 days that a defendant is normally entitled to.
Okay. Why is that improper? Because if you've got a 30-day period that's not charged to the defendant because it's the normal period that's allowed, why is it improper to charge him with that additional 15-some-odd days?
Well, under the plain language of the statute, Your Honor, the clock had not even started to run. This occurred on May 15th, the waiver of the preliminary, the 30-day rule. The district attorney and the trial counsel did not have notice of that request until May 19th, several days later. Clock begins upon notice of the request. So on May 15th, when this waiver occurred, there was nothing to toll.
But in the statute says that you don't start counting before you get notice?
Because the statute specifically says that notice begins on the later of two dates, when the district court has notice of the request or when the district attorney have notice of the request, and it's undisputed in this case that that notice occurred on May 19th, 3 days later.
So the difference of 3 days means that you don't count any of the time against him?
Right. As a matter of law, the clock wasn't even running. There's nothing to toll at that point. There's other reasons, of course, as I argue as to the second tolling, that there are statutory requirements here that in order to toll the UMDDA, you have to comply with those statutory requirements, and that's what I'll turn to just now. That second period of tolling was for defense counsel to review a plea offer the district attorney had offered that same day. And that tolling wasn't proper because the trial court did not comply with the UMDDA statutory requirements that at the time of the continuance is requested, the court must find good cause to toll the UMDDA in open court with defense counsel present. Second, there was no good cause to toll the UMDDA in this case because defense counsel had merely made one request for a short continuance very early on in the pretrial process, and therefore there was no reason to believe that at that time this continuance would impair the court or district attorney's ability to try the case by November 15th. And apparently neither the district court or the district attorney thought that the continuance would toll the UMDDA because neither so much as mentioned the statute at the time of the request. And well, it's their burden to comply with the statute.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. Let me take you back to the statute because you quoted a part of the statute, but there's another part. It says that, but the parties may stipulate for a continuance or a continuance may be granted on notice to the prisoner's attorney and opportunity to be heard. Isn't that a separate provision that doesn't deal with the good cause issue at all?
Right, we're not dealing with a stipulated continuance here. And that second language that Your Honor quoted has been interpreted by the courts in Colorado to refer to a stipulation at the request of the prosecution, to which they're only entitled one under People v. Suazo. So yes, those two provisions are not an issue here. Those are other exceptions that may result in extending the time period. At issue in this case is only that first part, the part where the court may grant additional time for good cause shown in open court with defense counsel or the defendant being present.
Tell me why the stipulation that was reached when the defense asked for additional time to consider the plea agreement doesn't fall within that statutory language, stipulate for a continuance or a continuance may be granted.
I don't believe there was a stipulation here, Your Honor. And if there were a stipulation, it wouldn't just be a stipulation for a routine continuance that would result in tolling of the UMDDA. It would be a stipulation to have trial outside of that UMDDA time period, and certainly nothing like that occurred in this case, and no one has argued otherwise. What I think is more important, however, is the fact that at the time the continuance is requested, there was no good cause to toll the UMDDA. It happened so early on in the pretrial process. The court and the district attorney didn't think they required any more time. Otherwise, presumably, they would have said something, as it is their burden to comply with the statutory time period. And finally, and probably most importantly, if this court were to hold that what happened in this case was proper and met the statutory criteria, and that's to say a retroactive ruling to toll in the absence of both notice and good cause, then the burden that's placed on the trial court and the district attorney to comply with the UMDDA is no burden at all. And the rights granted under the UMDDA would be rendered illusory, because in every routine request for a continuance would extend those 180 days and no defendant would come to trial within that statutory time period. What I believe happened in this case is that this request for continuance was made. It's early on in the process. There's still many months to bring Mr. Tucker to trial. The district attorney and both the court are aware of the request. They're aware of their obligation to bring Mr. Tucker to trial by November 15th. Frankly, they had no problem with that continuance. Indeed, the length of the continuance was in part precipitated by district attorney's request for a month. And so when that was set, nobody apparently had any problem with it. It's not until months down the road when this issue really comes to the forefront where the court makes this retroactive ruling that we're going to have tolling here. And at that point, still doesn't explain what good cause there was to toll. Because at that point, we did still have a month in that UMDDA deadline. I know that's not a lot of time at that point, but certainly back at the time of these so-called triggering events, you had months and months to bring the defendant to trial. And frankly, the court and the district attorney just didn't meet their burden here. They didn't take any steps to ensure that Mr. Tucker's pretrial process would comport with that deadline. They're in possession of the knowledge about whether or not they're going to be able to try him by November 15th. And the fact that they make no mention of it at the time belies their lack of concern about how that one continuance is going to impact their ability to try Mr. Tucker. So in a situation like this, where a continuance is requested, it's just a short routine thing, all that's going to do is change when those things that happen before trial in every case, and a preliminary hearing is generally one of those things, that's going to move around within the 180 days. If you get into a situation, which was not the case here, where you're coming up close to the deadline and there's still a lot that needs to be done and defense counsel is requesting a continuance, then at that point, the court has an obligation to step in and say, look, I understand you need that time, but look, we're right up against the UMDDA deadline. Court can either seek a waiver from the defendant or make its good cause findings on the record as the statute requires as to why the court needs more time. Some problems with the docket, witnesses that the district attorney says aren't going to be available. Those are all the things that could have gone into a good cause finding, and here the record is bare of any mention of what those concerns would have been. Instead, both people whose obligation it is to comply with the statute remain silent for months. If the court has no further questions for me, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal, please.
All right, thank you.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Clemmy Engel, number 6686, and I'm representing the people in this appeal. Now, I think this UMDDA issue could be analyzed several different possible ways. So, time permitting, I'm going to present three different analyses for your consideration, which I'm going to call Plan A, Plan B, and Plan C. And Plan A is my threshold argument that because he didn't sign the request, it was never valid. I'm going to defer that because I think my Plan B may be the least problematic. And Plan B and Plan C both involve different ways of calculating continuances or tolling under the statute. Plan B is the analysis I lay forth at pages 24 and 25 of the answer brief, and I think it's the most simple, direct, and least problematic way of deciding this case. Suppose you don't like my threshold argument that this was not a valid request. So let's assume for the moment that there was a valid request as of May 19th, 2008, and that the 180-day speedy disposition period started ticking on May 19th. I don't even think we need to deal with Judge Wheeler's allowing extra days for requesting more time for the preliminary hearing. I think we only need to look at two things. If the 180 days started on May 19th, then the 180 days would have expired on November 15th, absent any tolling or extension. So the first thing we need to look at is on July 10th, defense counsel requested a 43-day continuance of the preliminary hearing until August 21st. And he said that was because I need more time to prepare for the preliminary hearing.
Is that in addition to the May 15th motion to increase the time for the PS?
Yes, that was a separate.
Okay, so there were two different times.
Correct.
Okay, she is down May 15th, which preceded May 19th.
I include the May 19th extension in what I call my Plan C, which is basically Judge Wheeler's analysis. But to the extent the May 15th extension is problematic at all, we don't even need to look at it. Just forget about it for the moment. Starting with the July 10th, defense counsel says I want 43-day continuance to prepare for the preliminary hearing. So he gets a 43-day continuance. This tolls the 180-day period for 43 days. So it now expires on December 28th instead of November 15th. Second thing you need to look at is before the court would have lost jurisdiction on December 28th, on December 8th, the prosecution requests an emergency continuance of trial because counsel fell ill and was in the emergency room. And the trial court granted a continuance of trial for good cause until January 13th of 2009. And that extended or tolled the 180-day clock further until at least January 13th, which is when the trial commenced. And it's that simple. That's all you need to do to resolve this case. The defendant's argument, as I perceive it, seems to be that the first continuance requested by defense counsel in July, give me 43 more days to prepare for the preliminary hearing, somehow doesn't count because the parties and the court didn't expressly invoke or discuss the UMDDA on the record at the time. But I don't find any support in the statute or the case law for that. The cases are legion. Anderson, for example, where there's delays and continuances galore, and we don't have to go through a litany of discussing the pros and cons of all the different UMDDA factors on each occasion. And in fact, if their argument is valid, I can imagine a hypothetical where, say, there's a complex murder case and defense counsel asks for and gets 2 years of extensions, continuances, legitimately to prepare for trial, and then on the morning of trial 2 years later he says, he or she says, oh my gosh, by the way, 2 years ago my counsel filed a UMDDA speedy disposition request and all those continuances that I've asked for and have been granted don't count. Please dismiss the case.
So it's your position that the trial court's determination in December, when the emergency continuance was requested, was a good cause continuance within the meaning of the statute?
Correct. And I think, Your Honor, during the earlier segment of the argument, correctly identified, there's several different clauses in this statute, and we have to presume the defense, the legislature did not intend them to be redundant. So the statute reads, within 180 days after receipt of the request, or within such additional time as the court for good cause shown in open court may grant, or the parties may stipulate for a continuance, or a continuance may be granted on the prosecution's request and notice to the prisoner. I would say that the December continuance could fall under either a good cause extension or else a continuance granted on the prosecutor's request, which of course was good cause. I mean, there's some overlap there in our lingo, but I don't think anybody would deny that the illness of counsel, as it was presented on the record here, was good cause and a legitimate reason.
Does it matter that the trial court didn't use those magic words, good cause?
I believe that in the December 8th, I believe the trial court expressly did make a finding of good cause under the UMDDA. But even if not, I don't think it matters if they didn't use the magic words. I mean, Anderson in a lot of cases teaches that whenever a trial court's considering a continuance, whether in the UMDDA context or otherwise, implicitly the court is finding good cause. You could say, in a sense, that when the court granted defense counsel's 43-day motion for continuance to prepare for the preliminary hearing in July, the court found good cause. Now, the court didn't expressly say on the record, I'm weighing the factors here, I'm weighing the factor that if counsel says he needs more time to prepare for the preliminary hearing in a serious case, I take that as a legitimate concern. And on the other side of the equation, the prosecutor doesn't object, therefore I find good cause. I think that's all implicit in just the routine granting of a continuance in any trial court. What I call Plan C would actually incorporate Judge Wheeler's analysis. I prefer my Plan B is more simple. You could say that Judge Wheeler's analysis is arguably somewhat problematic because, in addition to the 43 days for tolling for the July 10th continuance, he also included the 25 days of tolling for waiving the 30-day preliminary hearing rule on May 15th. And as counsel points out, this was actually 4 days before this purported request was filed on May 19th. Nevertheless, I think under the circumstances, it's not legally erroneous, nor is it an abuse of discretion for Judge Wheeler to find that on the whole, there was good cause to extend this period for 68 days until January 22nd. And contrary to defendants' argument in their brief, they cited a couple cases, I believe Fleming and Lopez, for the proposition that a trial court can't include a waiver of the 30-day rule in a UMDDA extension or tolling, but I don't read those cases that way. In Fleming, the Supreme Court didn't address that issue. They decided the case on other grounds, and I mean, Lopez didn't have those kind of facts either. I'd also like to present my Plan A, which is, I dispute at the outset that this was a legitimate UMDDA request simply because the prisoner didn't sign the page where he was supposed to sign to say, I hereby invoke my speedy disposition period. Now, the defense would say, oh, come on, he sent in all this paperwork, he signed it in 2 out of 3 places, clearly he intended to invoke his right to speedy disposition, it doesn't matter if he didn't sign it in the correct place. But I think that's far from clear. I don't think we can tell the intent of the defendant from the paperwork itself. It's possibly, it's an entirely plausible speculation that he did intend to invoke the act, that he gave the paperwork to the DOC official and said, hey, send this in, I want to get my speedy dispo period ticking. But it's just as plausible a speculation that he signed the acknowledgement that he had been advised of the detainer. Second, he signed the acknowledgement that he had been advised of his right to request a speedy disposition. But thirdly, he chose not to sign the actual request itself and decided not to invoke his right and simply returned the paperwork unsigned to the DOC official who carelessly on her own processed it and sent it into court with the certificate of inmate status.
Nothing in the record to indicate conversation is there defendant and the DOC official preserved the
there is no extrinsic evidence. If there were, it would shed some light on the situation, but there's not. So on this record, I think we have to ask what makes a request, and it's a situation where in the absence of extrinsic evidence, you need to sign the actual request to evidence your intent to invoke the act.
But wasn't there substantial compliance?
Well, if I'm correct that this form was deficient from the outset, then he's got to rely on the, he didn't strictly comply with the statute, he has to rely on substantial some compliance. So what then? Where does the analysis go from there? And I submit that, excuse me, we would have to look at the Jess case for a model of analysis in that situation. If the unsigned form was deficient and didn't provide actual notice at the time it was filed, then under the Jess case, you would say that this defective request was, quote, perfected, end quote. That's Judge Russell's term, the Jess decision's term, was perfected under the rule of substantial compliance when it became clear in October 2008 in open court that he did indeed and did indeed intend to invoke the act, and any ambiguity or deficiency by his failure to sign the form was thereby cured by making his intent clear in open court. Now, if that's the case, the 180-day clock didn't even start ticking until October.
Didn't the DA concede that he had gotten or she had gotten the request by May 19th?
It's conceded that this paperwork landed in the DA's file on May 19th. It's conceded that it landed in the court's file on May 19th.
Isn't that enough, really? Isn't that enough? Are you really pushing plan A? Or did they make
There's probably a good reason why I said to you that plan B was less problematic. But look at the Jess case. There the prisoner's request admittedly landed in the file months beforehand. The only difference is his was much stranger and much less identified as having anything to do with the UMDDA. It was some homemade motion for writ of habeas corpus, and at the end of it he tried to sneak in a UMDDA request. Here at least the paperwork has UMDDA written all over it. It's just that the guy didn't sign it. It is quite true that in the trial court, once this came to the light of day, the DA, defense counsel, the trial court, everybody in the world treated this thing as if it had was valid on May 19th and had taken effect. My response to that is questions of law under the UMDDA are reviewed de novo, and I think it's entirely open to you to hold that as a matter of law, the request was deficient and was not perfected until October. And if there are no questions, that's what I have. Thank you very much.
I'd just like to touch on the so-called Plan A very briefly. I won't belabor the point. My first argument, as I made in the briefs, is that this argument was abandoned by the district attorney below when she conceded that she had actual knowledge of the request on May 19th. This isn't like Guess, because in Guess, he sends his request to just the district court, district court, and asked the district court to forward it on to the DA, which they did not do. So the DA didn't have it in her file, as the attorney general has suggested. She didn't learn about the request until it was mentioned in open court. That's not the situation here. The situation here is that she had the request on May 19th. The stamp shows she had it, and then she concedes that she had it on May 19th and specifically argued below that that's when the timing began. Even if this court chooses to address this argument, despite the fact that it was abandoned by the district attorney, as Judge Rockenberger pointed out, there was substantial compliance here. He did everything he was supposed to do. If the court has looked at the form, it's misleading. The signature line is smack in the middle, embedded in a bunch of other language, where the signature line is obvious. On the other forms, he signed it. No one through that entire process disputes the validity of the request. They all operate as though the request was valid. And that's what Mascarena says, is that when you substantially complied and the district attorney has actual knowledge, as here, the request is considered valid. Turning to the July 10th request for continuance, as I said before, it was a 43-day continuance, but that was actually at the request of the district attorney that it would be at least a month long. And the district attorney's job in this case is to comply with the statute. And if she believed that this continuance was going to impair her ability to try him by November 15th, then that's exactly what she should have said. She shouldn't have been requesting even more time, not mentioning the statute. And then months later, after essentially lying in wait, says, oh, by the way, this is going to toll your rights. You're going to lose your rights under the UMDDA.
Does the trial court have to parse out who's requesting what amount of time when both sides are fine with a continuance? I mean, you seem to be arguing that the defendant asks for some additional time to consider a plea offer and says, I need some more time. And the prosecution says, make it a month. Does the trial court have to say, well, I'm going to charge 15 days to the defendant because that's all defendant wanted, and I'm going to charge the balance to the prosecution? Or isn't it simply a stipulation for a continuance under those circumstances?
The only question that was before the court was whether this continuance was going to result and require more time to try Mr. Tucker. And there's no basis in the record to believe that it would have required more time than November 15th. That's what the statute requires of the court, is to find good cause to toll the UMDDA. And I think that's part of what is going on here, is that the Attorney General is conflating good cause for a period of time with good cause to toll the UMDDA. Those two things are not equivalent. Even if the trial court rightly grants defense counsel some time to review a preliminary offer, that doesn't mean per se that the UMDDA needs to be told. If there is a concern with granting that continuance for perfectly good reason, that in so doing, they're going to need more time under the UMDDA, then all the court has to do is say, based on this request for continuance, I find that there's good cause to toll the UMDDA because now you've pushed this and you've pushed this and my docket is congested during that time and I don't believe we can bring it to trial within the UMDDA time period. And then he's made his good cause finding. And importantly, had that happened in this case, then defense counsel would have known exactly what was going on at the time of his request. He would have been on notice that, look, when I request these continuances, even though they're happening so early in the pretrial process, they're going to toll the UMDDA. At that point, he can adjust his behavior. He can say, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't need those 43 days. In light of your ruling, I just need a week. Or he can let the defendant know how this is going to affect his rights. In this case, defense counsel could have.
Sorry to interrupt. Just sure. One quick question. On the July 10th, did defense counsel have notice and an opportunity to be heard on the request to continue? It was a DA request.
She had notice. The defense counsel was the one who requested the continuance. And then the court turned to the district attorney, and the district attorney said, I need about a month, Your Honor. But again, good cause to grant the extra time is not the same question as good cause under the UMDDA. If it were, then every request for continuance would extend the UMDDA, and those rights would be eviscerated under the statute.
And did he have notice on December 8th that was a DA request?
On December 8th? Well, my position on December 8th is it's irrelevant because it was beyond the November 15th deadline. And I would like to address that point. I see I've run out of time, but if I could answer your question. The Attorney General's recollection of the record is not quite accurate. Specifically, they addressed that emergency continuance, and both the defendant and defense counsel said, Your Honor, I understand the need for the continuance, but we did not consent to any tolling of the UMDDA. We ask that it be reset within this recalculated time period, and the trial court agreed. The trial court did not toll the UMDDA. The trial court reset the trial within the UMDDA time period. That is the opposite of tolling. That's the trial court accommodating this request within that speedy trial period. For these reasons, we would ask the court to reverse the trial court's ruling and vacate the convictions because the trial court and district attorney did not comply with the UMDDA. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.